Hello, it's Irit calling.
Hi, can you hang on for just one second?
Sure. I'm over the phone, so I'm now experimenting with recording.
From one room to another.
Okay, are you up for this?
Well, let's start, we'll see.
Okay, I have no idea if this is going to work. I'm having to try and record it from the phone, so who knows what will happen. I wish I could meet with you. I'm sorry that you won't. Anyway.
I don't know. It's not easy for me to meet with new people. So let's start on the phone. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Do you want to know anything about, or know anything about me and my background, or do you just want to tell me stuff?
Well, I'd like to know what you're doing this for, whether it's for paper or for class assignment or whatever.
Just it's for a book.
For a book, yes?
Yes. I was funded by the Canada Council to write to attempt to write a history of the psychiatric survivors movement in Canada.
Yes.
And I don't know a lot about it, and one of the things I don't know about it is what happened in Vancouver in early days before anything was happening anywhere else. And Don White suggested that you would be an excellent authority on that. The early days of MPA specifically. Which I understand was quite a radical sort of thing before it became much more conservative.
That's my understanding. I haven't had no contact with him probably 20 years. I left in 1975, I think. Have you had any background as a psychiatric patient?
Oh, God, yes. I was locked up when I was 20 for several months and then released on large amounts of Haldol and locked up again when I was 21 and escaped from my third place when I was 22. And then I was the editor of Phoenix Rising for 4 years after that. I was locked up in 1978 to 1980, and 1986 to 90 I was the editor of Phoenix Rising. 1990 to 1992, I was the coordinator of the Ontario Psychiatric Survivors Alliance, which was a group that me and a whole bunch of other people founded in Toronto.
Yes. So, you know, I was the publisher of the book Shrink Resistant. I don't know if you knew that.
I'm sorry, the publisher of what?
The book Shrink Resistant, you know, the book that Don...
Yes, of course, I know. I have a story in it, actually.
So anyway, so that's what I, after I left MPA, I had a year of being, I was in hospital and had a year of being completely dysfunctional, and then I published books for 15 years after that. And of all the books that I published, Shrink Resistant was the only one that was specifically related to issues of mental patients. So I was away from that area for a very long time, although I've always maintained an interest in it. And for about 5 years in the late 80s, I actually published a fair amount of my own writing, including a number of articles on psychiatry, which you might be interested in. I don't know if you've seen them, but you might be interested in looking at them.
Do you have copies of them that I could see?
Yeah, I do have copies.
Oh, I would love to see them.
Okay, I'll have two.
Okay.
Why don't you give me your name and address now? So.
Okay. My name is Irit.
Is that a problem for you to give me your name and address? I know some people don't like you.
No, what I really want to do is meet you if you're willing, but it sounds like you don't want to, so I'm...
I'm not saying I don't want to. As we talk, it might become clear whether I can or can't, or you might understand why I can or can't.
Okay.
I'm hard meeting new people.
Okay. I'm pretty easy.
Vancouver?
To...
I mean, are you just in passing through?
Oh, I moved here 2 years ago.
So you live here?
Yes.
Okay, so the timetable for us talking is not...
It's pretty loose. It's whenever you could cope with it, basically. I'm, as I say, I've already passed my deadline, and I feel like it's important to find out more than I know about what was happening here, you know, all that time ago. And
do you have the early MPA literature?
No, I don't really have... All I've seen is a thing about the Emotional Emergency Center,
yes.
Which I don't know even what relation that had to MPA.
No formal relation. There was overlap in the people who were part of the two groups.
I wrote an article about the stuff I saw on that that I could show you if you want. That's in a thing that a magazine that I published called Second Opinion, or that I edited rather, called Second Opinion, which is the newsletter. It's not really a magazine. It's the newsletter of the Second Opinion Society, which is an anti-psychiatry group in the Yukon.
In the Yukon.
Yeah, they started after hearing a radio show I did on ideas called Analyzing Psychiatry. That was part of what inspired a few people there to get together and start a group a few years ago. And when they got around to doing a newsletter, they decided I should be the editor of it, and it's rather wonderful, no thanks to me, and I'd love to show it to you as well.
What years were those with Second Opinion?
The Second Opinion Society is still going now, and the newsletter, only the first two issues have been published, and I don't know whether there'll be another one or not, and it was last year and this year.
Yeah.
Do you want me to ask you questions about history over the phone, or?
Yeah, why don't we start with that?
I appreciate that you'll talk to me at all.
I do have a filing cabinet full of old MPA documents going right back to the beginning, and I guess you should have access to that. I guess I would like you to have access to that, because it sounds just...
Well, sure, I would love to.
Mine are pretty similar, I would guess.
It would be really good to see that stuff for sure.
Well, why don't we just start? Why don't we start talking about... You start asking me some questions.
Okay.
And we can see how it goes, and we should, I guess, change addresses so we can send stuff.
Okay. Can you hear me clearly?
Yeah.
All right. I'm getting the beginning and ends of when you talk cut off just a tiny bit, because I have I've got my phone on speakerphone mode in order to try and record.
Yes.
I'm
not really I've never used a speakerphone, but I guess I know what they are.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure that you, because I think
technology that makes communication more difficult, right? That's what most communication.
That's correct. But it does make it easier to record. I tried recording it without doing that, and it didn't work.
Yes.
So anyway,
I'm glad you told me you're recording it.
Oh, sure, I would tell you. And I don't know whether it'll work, but I guess I'll just try it anyway.
Like, what do you mean by work?
In terms of the recording, so I'm also going to try and take notes. But what's happened so far for me in this conversation is that when you and I think we're both talking at the same time, presumably me interrupting you, since I tend to do that sometimes.
Or I was interrupting you, yes.
I don't think so. Then I missed something that you were saying.
So you can ask me again if you miss something.
Okay, thanks. All right, then. Do you want to say anything in the context of, you know, your work in the movement about your own psychiatric history that I could use in my book, or do you not want to get into that for this?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I was very public. When I was at MPA, I was very public as being someone who had been in mental hospitals.
Well,
and since then, I have been... I published books, and I published them in the basement of my house. And I have led quite a reclusive life. I have really been out of the public, off the public stage. Publishing is a wonderful thing, because publishing, you get your products put on the public stage, but you're anonymous. I mean, my name's hardly ever appeared in any of my books.
I agree. I absolutely love publishing, but it's kind of like being on the public stage also.
There's too much for me.
Yeah. I got an opportunity to do that when I was doing OPSA, which is Ontario Psychiatric Survivors Alliance, and I got quite a kick out of it, actually. Anyway, what can you tell me about how MPA... Were you there when MPA started? Were you part of the... Can you tell me about how it began?
Yes, I can. This is prehistory. I was at the Burnaby Mental Health Day Clinic, which is a day program that runs from 9 to 4 a.m., 9 p.m. 9 a.m. to 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. 5 days a week, and not on the weekend. And in the first 3 months that I was there, three people committed suicide all on the weekend.
Wow.
And started off one Monday morning session, and the head shrink said, "I have some bad news. Gordon McKinnon, not the right name, Gordon McKinnon suicided over the weekend." And because there were 20 of us in the program, we only knew each other's first names, basically, for the most part, and there were two Gordons in the program, and I found my eyes darting around the room to see which Gordon was there and which wasn't. And other people did the same thing. And so there was something in that moment that sort of said, like, this is our common fate. Any one of us could be Gordon. And we don't know who we are, right? We don't know which Gordon is the dead Gordon and which is the live Gordon. There's something really wrong here.
God.
And later on, I thought, you know, how that the shrink used suicide as a verb. He suicided over the weekend, which, you know, this is like, I'm interested in language.
Yes, me too.
Yeah.
I've actually heard a lot of people who live in mental health land use suicide as a verb.
Yeah.
What year are you talking about?
1970. Fall of 1970.
Okay.
And so I suggested that the people in the program, called patients, put together a phone list so that we could call each other. And the staff was initially resistant to that because not good for, they know there's something wrong about sort of mental patients associating on their own.
Was that ever explained, what's wrong with that?
No, it wasn't ever explained. And they didn't, and the resistance wasn't very long or hard. I mean,
What did it consist of?
The resistance?
Yes.
That mental patients, when they're together without the supervision of trained professionals, might hurt each other. The irony, of course, is that three mental patients had committed suicide while supposedly under the supervision of trained professionals.
It's pretty ironic, all right.
So it's pretty hard to imagine mental patients doing much worse, you know, to each other.
Yeah.
That we would somehow be responsible for three suicides in 3 months. So the phone list happened within a week or so, and so phone calls started happening, and then I, Bob, what's his name? I have all these, Bob Hunter was a radical hippie columnist for the Vancouver Sun at the time, Vancouver Sun then, because at that time it was reasonable to have a hippie, radical, left-wing journalist there. And he happened at this time to be doing a series of really scathing articles on Riverview Mental Hospital. And two things happened around the time. One is I wrote him a letter telling him that I was thinking of starting an organization of mental patients. And the other was that I was interested in getting some information, more information, just about the sort of statistical and factual stuff about the mental health world. And I had a friend who was a librarian, and about six of the people who were in the program, in the Burnaby Mental Health, in the day program, about six of us went to a library one Sunday afternoon, and my librarian friend had pulled out a whole bunch of stuff. And we spent a couple of hours going through it and kind of organizing it and so on. And Bob Hunter responded to my letter within a day or two and said that he was interested in doing anything he could to help start this organization. And so he did a column on this idea, which fit naturally into, you know, his series of Riverview columns.
Mm-hmm.
And put my name and number in the thing, and the phone just didn't stop ringing for days and days and days and days. And within 2 weeks of that column, I had been approached by, one thing is I was just approached by all sorts of people who had been mental patients who wanted to give things, who wanted to do things and give things. And so one of the guys who phoned was a guy who owned a house, and he said, "How would you like to rent the house?" And I said, "Sounds great." And so it was in, I think, December of 1990, we had our first meeting in the basement of the house because the people living upstairs weren't leaving until the end of the month.
Okay, sorry, what year? 1970?
Did I say something else?
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah. I think it was December 1970. And I have documents about all this.
Okay.
And there were about, at least there were 80 to 100 people there.
Wow.
In the basement.
Wow.
And...
I'm sorry, was that your basement or the basement of this house?
The basement of the house that we were going to rent.
Okay.
Which we did rent the whole house within, I don't know, several weeks of that.
Wow.
It's like all these things just absolutely started to fall into place right away. And so at the meeting, there were two things that happened. One is there were just a lot of testimonials by people talking about their the agonies that they had had, both from the suffering from what's called mental illness and also how it had been often compounded by the treatment that they'd gotten. That was one thing that happened. So a lot of talking just about personal stories.
How did you get people to start doing that? Did you start by doing it yourself?
I don't remember, but it didn't seem as if it took anything to start it. It seemed that these were stories that people had inside them and probably that they had told others, but that they were... They could hardly prevent themselves from talking about it. These were the core issues of their lives, and they basically had not had a forum in which to talk about them except to friends or family, and often that was impossible.
Yes.
So here are all these, you know, crazy people together.
Yes.
With common stories and common interests. And really, MPA was, it was an outgrowth of women's liberation and gay liberation. That it wasn't an outgrowth. It was an outgrowth of the same impulse that began those two. It was just part of the radical times. And there were people like R.D. Lang around and so on, and you know, who were saying that crazy people actually have some wisdom. We actually can learn something from them and so on. So these were really like extreme ideas,
mm-hmm.
wonderful ideas that have disappeared now.
Yes.
Now we're living in like the post-Reagan ice age, you know, in which, you know, we live in a society of positive thinking in which the worst thing you can possibly have is mental illness. Because what could be more negative than mental illness?
How did this come about, this change, in your opinion?
Which change?
From all that hope and stuff happening to where we are now?
Well, I mean, there's a number of ways to look at it. Reagan, Mulroney, Thatcher, Bennett, Van der Zandt.
Yeah.
Neoconservatism, the triumph of capitalism over the little dream of the 60s. It was a big dream, but in fact, it only produced crumbs, important crumbs. So there was this thing called the 60s, which lasted from about 1965 to 1975. And not coincidentally, those were almost exactly the years when the Vietnam War was a big, major political recognized public issue. And in 1975, the National Liberation Front and North Vietnam won the war, ultimately took over Vietnam, renamed Saigon Ho Chi Minh City, and I think both symbolically and in real terms, that ended the 60s. Hmm. I think that if it wasn't for the war in Vietnam, I think the war in Vietnam was the core thing around which all the other issues revolved, and there were a million of them, from native rights to women's and gay rights and civil rights, all of that. I think that it was the war that was like the consolidating center of that, and when the war ended, that went, and also there was an enormous change in the economy that happened in the mid-70s, which was that the post-World War II boom of incredible affluence, fairly widely distributed, stopped. And I have, if you're interested, I have interesting stuff. But there's a graph. If there was a Martian who came to me and said, show me a graph that would tell me most about what's happened in the last 25 years, I would give him this graph that shows how the average household income in the U.S. went from 1945 to 1973, just went up, 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 and in 1973 it just tailed off, and it has not risen since then. So with the end of the movement of the 60s, and with real economic reasons, the political mood shifted, and a period of incredible reaction came in, which was spearheaded in the U.S. by the Reagan administration. And so, what progressive ideas had to do, instead of trying to advance, they were simply trying to defend themselves. Feminism being like the best example of the backlash, or the apparent backlash against feminism, you know, were ideas that at one time were seen by many as being justifiable, now had to justify themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And mental patients issues, which was a very, very minor part it was almost invisible. In fact, 99% of people who were in the movement even didn't know about it. But it was somehow piggybacked on women's liberation and gay liberation and other movements. And so with the conservative swing that began in the mid to late 70s and was consolidated in the 80s, that mental patient issues became not just on the back burner, but virtually off the stove entirely. And I view that with a lot of personal torment. Because I see that what happened, there were a lot of things I wanted MPA to accomplish, and it did accomplish a lot of things. It provided housing for a lot of people. It provided a community for a lot of people. But on the political stage, I wanted to see a real cut into the stigma of mental illness. And I think the stigma is greater now than it was then. In fact, I'm sure it's greater now than it was then.
Are you aware of what went on in Ontario from 1990 to 1992 in this context?
I don't think so.
Do you want me to tell you a story? Or do you want to go on with yours? Let's go on with yours. Tell me about the early days of MPA, anything you can.
Well, one of the things most people in MPA came to MPA. First of all, MPA was, we were not looking for healthy mental patients. Like, we really wanted the doors to be open to everyone, and that meant especially to be open to the people at the bottom, like people who slept in cars and people who burned holes in with their cigarettes in chairs because they were too out of it and so on.
Yes.
The people who came to MPA, many, many of them, were people who had not only no sense of having a say in or power in a group situation. I mean, they were just totally powerless people. And I guess the one word that we really tried to, that I would say really, we really tried and succeeded in doing is in making MPA democratic.
I need to know two things. One is, how did you get those people to come? And two is, how did you make it democratic? How did you get street people and people who were really down and out and burning holes in chairs to together?
Well, there are a number of ways. First of all, people who sleep in cars, they find out about a place like MPA where they can actually go and just sit in the couch and just be warm all day.
How do they find out?
Well, they found out either by word of mouth, but professionals started sending people to MPA.
Aha.
Because professionals don't deal with people like that, or they don't want to deal with people like that. I mean, psychiatrists don't deal, as I said in one of my articles, that the more education you have in dealing with the more education you have about mental illness, the less time you have to spend with the mentally ill. Right? Psychiatrists don't see schizophrenics.
Right.
So professionals all over the place started sending people to MPA, just tell them to go around and see what's happening. There's word of mouth stuff, and it was part of a culture. I mean, there was a counterculture, you know, in Vancouver, and you know, MPA was part of it.
Did Vancouver used to be? I guess it must have used to be a lot more political than it is now.
Well, I mean, I think that in what was called the 60s, that Vancouver was an active center, like almost all other major cities.
Right.
There was a real, you know, like the Georgia Strait started then, which was, I mean, now it's just a freebie rag, which, you know, the entertainment rag. But at the time, it was a political newspaper begun by a collective.
Did it ever print anything about psychiatry?
Well, I remember I published something in it.
Do you have that?
I might. I remember publishing a very personal piece. And it was at the time that I think, I'm pretty sure I was at the Burnaby Mental Health Program at the time. Yeah, I'm sure I have it. I don't know if I can find it. I suffer from fear of filing.
Do you remember what was in it at all?
It was a sort of literary account of my psychic horrors.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm sure that it must have had a political dimension, which is, because I never write anything that doesn't. But.
Well, that does intrinsically, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it does intrinsically.
Did you write about your madness or whatever it was that happened to you, as well as the psychiatrization?
I haven't published very much about that. I mean, I've written literally thousands of pages about it, but it was not published.
Okay.
There was that piece in the Georgia Strait. I don't know. But as I say, I have published a number of pieces. I have published probably four or five, other than stuff that was in the MPA newsletter in a nutshell. Mid-80s. In fact, it was doing the book Shrink Resistant that got me again interested in mental patients' issues as issues. And so I published four or five articles.
When was that?
Between about 1985 and 1989.
Can I see them?
Yes.
Excellent.
Why don't you make a list of these things so I don't have to, then you...
Okay.
So there's a 1970 Georgia Strait article.
Okay.
There are the articles, say 1985 to 1989, psychiatry articles.
Copies of the newsletter?
And I think I have copies of all the newsletters until I left in 1974 or 5.
Okay.
Back then, I don't think I had fear of filing. I was a compulsive filer, so I have a very detailed, documentary history of the organization.
That's so impressive. I wish I had one of mine. I have terrible fear of filing, and I've been putting off my filing for 3 years now, and I have all these boxes of stuff that are right now scattered over my living room waiting for me to open them if I can get over it.
Well, I just wrote a letter to a friend saying that I made my New Year's resolution on July the 7th or whatever it was, which was divide all my writing into two categories, letters and everything else.
Yeah.
Any letters that don't get in envelopes and mailboxes within a week, put in the everything else category. Better go try to remember, edit, improve, regret, find, publish, etc. Forget about it. I can't do that, but my life would be much better if I could. But instead I have just puddles of paper everywhere, and I can remember sort of the stuff for the last couple of days, and then I'll look at something I can hardly remember having written it a week ago.
Wow.
But, yeah. So democratic. The best thing that happened at MPA, I remember this happening a number of times, is someone really down and out, really out of it, like walking in when a meeting was going on, or lots of meetings. And there should be lots of meetings. Lenin had a phrase about ultra-democracy as something bad about it. I thought ultra-democracy was the best thing for MPA. There was nothing better people could do than spend their time in meetings talking about how to decide how to run their lives.
Hmm.
And so somebody who was really out of it would come in the door, and they'd see this meeting, and they'd stand at the back, or they'd go get coffee, and, you know, they're just out of it, you know. They must have seen as what was going on as a zoo, like, you know. And then 2 or 3 months later, they'd be sitting in a meeting, like, putting, you know, yelling about, you know, what they thought about some issues, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I thought, like, that's what it was about.
Yeah.
That's what it was about. And so there was also, as part, there was a very strong kind of there's a very strong kind of anarchist impulse that was part of the times, too, which was a suspicion of leaders and organizations and all that stuff. And so someone said at one of the first meetings, well, we should elect a president. And I remember saying, well, why don't we just see if we can just get along without having, like, people with those titles? And so, in fact, there never was a president of MPA. I mean, we groped around for names of people, for the people who were elected to do things, and finally came up with the word coordinator. So everybody had, like, would be either an office coordinator or a residence coordinator or a drop-in coordinator and so on. So that was one of the ways that it was sort of amazing that it worked, that it really didn't require, it didn't have a formal structure, it didn't have a formal power structure.
So there was no overall coordinator?
There was no overall coordinator, no. So there was no formal ultimate authority.
Was there, like, a board of directors and that kind of thing? Were you incorporated or anything?
There was a board of directors, and I remember that, too. It was a general meeting, and we'd just gotten these papers that there were important reasons to incorporate, right, which is because you get advantages if you're incorporated as a nonprofit society. And so there had to be 5 people on the board of directors, according to the thing. And so we just said, the first 5 people come in, will you sign this thing? We signed this paper. And so the first 5 people did, and we sent it back to Victoria. And other than that, so far as I remember, that it had absolutely no, you know, real relevance at all.
Hmm.
And then... MPA was 2 things. It was a service organization and a political organization. And what I thought, which is the opposite of what most people on the left say. Most people on the left say politics has to be the basic determinant. And I thought, no, this organization, first of all, has to be a service organization. That is self-help, people giving each other services. I don't like the term services, but it was a self-help organization, okay. And that had to be fundamental. And secondly, it was a service organization. Secondly, it was a political organization. And I played a big role because I had a lot of radical ideas and for various reasons. Anyway, so I had a big role in articulating the politics of the organization, but it was quite clear that there wasn't a correct line, and lots of people disagreed with me and thought I was some kind of crazy socialist hippie or whatever, you know, and somehow that, on the whole, was just incorporated into it and was fine, and I really tried hard not to have people see that my ideas or those who shared my ideas were the correct ideas. Because mostly this is about creating a community.
You're a lot smarter than I am.
This was 1970, 71. It was easy to be smart then because the times are so different. And how old are you?
37.
Yeah, so I'm 52. So in 1971, you were 1970. You were.
I was. I was born in 58, so I was 12.
Yes. So you got to see that part of the culture as 12-year-old. I got to see it as I guess I was in my late 20s. Well, how old was I? 70. I was late 20s. The point about being a service organization meant that we would seek money from government.
Yes.
And again, because of the times, so you say I was smarter than you are. It was the times were so different. There was tons of money around. At that time, there was something called LIP, Local Initiative Programs.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people get grants to videotape other groups doing videotapes or something. You know, it was money to buy off these sort of hippie radicals. And it basically worked. And actually, that was one real talent that I had, was being able to write applications and deal with people and get money. And so MPA quickly got, like, huge, I mean, for a new organization, for a neo-fed organization, got really large amounts of money. I think in the fourth year when I left, I think our budget was about $250,000 a year. And we started 4 years earlier, our budget was zero.
You know what? Me and these other bunch of people started OPSA, Ontario Psychiatric Survivors Alliance, in January of 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1991, we scored $500,000 for the provincial organization, for the provincial office, and $500,000 were also acquired by local groups that we'd started.
That's great.
Yeah, and you know, the whole thing exploded and died in 1992.
Because of?
A variety of things. We did everything wrong. We had leaders. I was one of them. We were elitist and undemocratic.
But were you providing services?
No, we weren't. Our mandate, I think, said that we weren't allowed to provide services.
Yeah.
We were starting new groups, which were... are you familiar with the Graham Report?
Don't think so.
It's a piece of bullshit that came out of the government sort of working with the Canadian Mental Health Association in the late 80s.
Ontario or federal?
The Graham report, I think, is Ontario, but there was also a federal mental health report, and both of them said consumer participation, partnership, major stakeholders, list 1, 2, 3, 4, number 4 is mental patients.
Mm-hmm.
Consumers, pardon me.
That's right, consumers.
Yes, precisely. And that was, of course, among other things, an attempt to co-opt people who were squawking, such as Phoenix Rising, that is me being the editor of that. I got picked up by this wave of strange stuff. Are you aware of the conference that took place in Montreal in 1989 called Our Turn?
I'm not sure.
It was the only national Canadian lunatics conference, consumer, survivor, whatever conference. And it was started by, or the idea of it came from a group of self-help organizations, alternatives in Quebec, and a whole bunch of people from each part, well, a few people from some parts of Canada and a whole bunch of people from Ontario went to it, and it was a group of people who attended that who decided to start OPSA when we got back to Ontario and after it was over. And it was at that conference that the participants had a vote on what we were going to call ourselves and decided that we would call ourselves psychiatric survivors, which was a term that we got from our guest speakers from the States and from England.
Yeah.
Judy Chamberlain and Louise Pembroke. I don't know if you know either of them.
Yeah, I knew Judy. She was around MPA a lot.
Yeah, I met her in the course of doing OPSA, and I am overcome with admiration for her, and especially for her writing, but also I like her a lot.
Years ago.
Yeah, this was, my knowing her was in, I guess, 90 to 92. Anyway, I really want to meet with you, and I definitely want to talk to you more than this once, if you'll put up with that. And I guess I should stop babbling about my stuff and ask you some more about your stuff.
I don't know. I would like to cooperate with you totally, and I'm hoping that if we talk on the phone that I'll be able to meet with you, and then I can sit down and I can give you these documents.
That would be great. Hearing.
If we don't, you definitely can have access to these things that I'm talking about.
Thank you, but I definitely want to talk with you more too, because I. What I know this sounds stupid, but I really like what you're saying a lot, and it's really exciting to me to hear about this stuff happening. Like, I sort of knew stuff had happened in Vancouver 20 years before OPSA happened that was similar, but I didn't realize how similar and how different that I'm now starting to realize it was, and I need to know lots more than I can ask you about this evening, I think.
Well, I'm willing to talk to you as much as you want.
Thank you. That's fabulous. I'm really pleased. I don't know anybody, you know, in this city. I haven't been here very long, and I don't know that many people from here, but I only know a couple of people who are interested in this issue at all.
Yes.
And of those, only, well, the number who's actually been locked up is about zero. It's friends of mine, and you know Persimmon Blackbridge?
What's the name again?
Persimmon Blackbridge. She.
The book Still Sane?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. She's a friend of mine, and is interested in anti-psychiatry or whatever you want to call it, but it has too many other things to do with her life to, you know, to give that tons of time, although she's certainly giving it an impressive amount of time. But I was astonished coming to Vancouver to find that there was nothing of what had was brewing in Ontario and had blossomed in the Yukon. there's nothing here. And then I talked to people, and people said, well, the only political issue in BC is the environment.
Yeah.
Everybody's got mold on their brains from all the moisture and is very, very mellow.
Yeah. See, I'm quite reclusive. I don't go out much. And what I know about what's going on out there is less than I've ever known. So you probably know more than I do about what's actually going on in Vancouver.
What I know is that there is a thing called the West Coast Mental Health Network.
Yeah, yes, I saw one of their newsletters.
Did you see their most recent one, do you know?
It was about a year ago.
Okay, they've done... what did you think about it?
I tend to be very tolerant of people who I see as leaning in what I call the right direction. I tend to be very sympathetic to anybody that has the slightest rebellious instinct.
Did you find much of that in there?
I remember finding... the one thing I remember is that they used the term consumers. It stuck in my mind. But on the whole, I would say my attitude toward it was that it was better that it existed than